Well, welcome to the First Liberty Institute's regular teleforum and podcast covering the coronavirus and its impact on religious liberty. My name is Jeremy Dice. I'm an attorney with First Liberty.
And I'm Justin Butterfield, another attorney here at First Liberty.
Well, Justin, it has been quite a week since our last teleforum. After we heard from our friends last week at the White House, President Trump signed into law what we know now as the CARES Act, a $2 trillion relief package meant to spur the economy affected by the coronavirus outbreak.
That's right. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from someone who has evaluated that legislation and its implications for religious organizations. But first, let's discuss the other big thing that has led to a lot of questions over the past week and that we've been talking about from day one, how government restrictions on large gatherings are impacting churches and religious organizations. In fact, in the past week, we've sent several letters to state and local governments that we thought didn't quite get the balance right between protecting residents from the coronavirus and respecting Americans' religious liberty rights. And we urge them to revise their policies, and thankfully most have. And I know, Jeremy, you've been busy responding to press inquiries about these concerns around the country.
In fact, I have. Whether it was New York City Mayor de Blasio's careless comments threatening the permanent closure of houses of worship in one of the world's premier cities, or just stories about pastors facing the prospect of arrest for failing to abide by various shelter-in-place orders, we've tried to communicate carefully that now is the time for prudence, not defiance, even as we insist that government officials tread carefully when it comes to religious liberty.
Well, that's a good point. As we've said from the beginning, this is a time for church and state to work together, not only to combat the effects of this pandemic, but to ensure that religious liberty is protected. And for the most part, that is what's happening.
Yeah, I agree. And a key individual that has been carefully monitoring that balance between state action and religious liberty is Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. He was sworn into office on January 5th of 2015 and became the 51st Attorney General of the state of Texas. As the state's top law enforcement officer, Attorney General Paxton leads more than 4,000 employees, including 750 attorneys handling roughly 30,000 cases annually. And relevant to our discussion today, General Paxton has been consistently vigilant in the protection of religious liberty, especially since so many other states today look to the example of Texas as they set it out. General Paxton, along with his special counsel, David Hacker, join us on the line. We're grateful that you would spend time with us today.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for having me on. Obviously, this is a very important issue for our nation right now, so I appreciate you having me on.
We're so grateful that you're here. General Paxton, let me get right to the center of the question that has been on the minds of many since the start of our efforts to slow the spread of this virus. And that question is this: Are we able to combat the effects of this virus while also protecting religious liberty?
That's a great question. It's a challenging question, but I would say the answer is yes. And I think Kelly Shackford's article in the Washington Post is exactly on point: prudence versus defiance. Certainly, government has to treat churches no different. They can't treat them worse in these cases and make it more difficult for them to operate than other organizations or other businesses. Maybe Mayor de Blasio had suggested shutting them down, but that is not that would not be something we support. And as you said earlier, my office has really probably had more focus on religious liberty cases and issues than maybe any other state attorney general in the history of the country. But while we've done that, we also realize this is a national crisis, that there is a compelling government interest to protect the lives of people. And if we don't cooperate with government officials in stopping the spread of the virus, obviously that's going to impact lives and people are going to die. And so clearly the answer is yes. There is a way for us to work with the government and still protect religious liberty.
General Paxton, as a native Texan, I'm especially thankful for your leadership to ensure religious liberty is protected, even while we take extraordinary action to guard against the effects of this virus. And at First Liberty, we have received quite a few questions asking about the balance between what local officials are doing and what the White House and the CDC are saying, along with what the governors may be directing. And sometimes what cities and counties say doesn't agree with what the governor directs. Can you explain how your office thinks through these issues and what direction it provides to ensure the state's interests in public health are achieved with minimal interruption to religious liberty?
Well, as you are getting questions, so are we. Every single day we're getting questions to clarify, because we're operating in a different world where you have governors and presidents and local officials operating with powers they typically don't have. And so there's a lot of confusion about it. There's sometimes a lack of clarity in the law, because we've We haven't been in this spot before. But in my state particularly, the governor has the authority over the locals. So if there's a contradiction between the governor's pronouncement and locals, the governor's pronouncement is what guides us. It gets a little more complicated when we're dealing with federal guidelines, because obviously the federal government has certain powers, but certain other powers are reserved to the state. So those tend to come down to sort of individual analysis and figuring out what we're going to do based on the facts and the law in that particular situation. Now, we did put out some guidelines that I'd like David Hacker, who's special counsel to the Attorney General, to kind of quickly go over. David, if you wouldn't mind just quickly covering those, that'd be great.
Yeah, General Paxton, thanks so much. You're right. We did issue some guidance earlier this week in conjunction with the Office of the Governor. And earlier this week, the governor made clear that in Texas, worship, houses of worship, churches, and other religious bodies are essential services. I think there's no question about that. Now, the governor and our office and our guidance clarified that, listen, as houses of worship, we need to do our part to serve our communities and be the best servants to our neighbors and to help them out. And so when possible, houses of worship should try to do things remotely, you know, use the online technology that we have these days to conduct services, be creative in how pastors reach out to their congregants by phone, by video conference, by other means. But sometimes we realize that's not possible. And we want to make sure that religious liberty is protected throughout Texas. And so if it isn't possible to conduct services remotely, what our guidance recommends is that churches follow White House and CDC guidelines to help stop the spread. That includes everything from hand washing and maintaining social distancing to making sure that the churches are sanitized and cleaned in between services and that sort of thing. And then we also finally just recommended that churches work with their local counties and cities to figure out how bad the spread of the virus is in their area. Texas is a big state. Our country is even bigger. And so the approach that one church might take in one part of the country or state is going to be different than a church in another part of Texas or the country. And so if the community is experiencing really substantial transmission of the virus, then maybe it is a time to cancel in-person church and to go online to do the video services. But if it's not a situation where the virus is spreading rapidly throughout the community, maybe there's some other ways that you can still have church in person, but make sure that your vulnerable population groups aren't there and are cared for in other ways, and be creative in the other ways that you provide ministry to your communities, whether that be drive-through communion, whether that be holding Easter services maybe outside in the parking lots. You can get that distancing, but still have that fellowship. And so our guidance, which I commend to everyone, tries to strike that balance between ensuring that religious liberty is protected and upheld during this national crisis, but also recognizing that we as the church need to do our part to help minimize the spread of the virus and serve our neighbors.
Very helpful ways to think through that guidance, and we're grateful that you guys have thought through that for us and put that out there. Let me ask you one more question, General Paxton. This is a little less of a legal question and more of kind of a, well, let's remember who we're talking to today. There's many pastors and religious leaders listening on this call and into the recording that will be posted later on our website. They have congregations to lead, and it's a real time of panic for them to be leading. How would you encourage those that are tasked with leading these houses of worship to respond during this pandemic?
Well, one is, as much as possible, I'd say cooperate, because there's a reason to prevent people from being together and contaminating each other. It's clear that they have a compelling reason. And I would say be creative. I think David covered this a little bit. Be creative. Try to think about ways that you can minister differently than maybe you have in the past. This may be a great opportunity to start things that otherwise would never have been started and that can be used going forward, even beyond the crisis that we're facing now. And then I'd say, you know, we need need spiritual leaders, and we particularly need them right now as people are living in, you know, a lot of fear about their health and about financial issues and their families, and they don't. This is, I think, a real opportunity for spiritual leaders, for pastors, for church leaders to step forward and provide answers for people that may not have been looking when their 401k was where it was a few months ago, but they may be looking for answers now when their health is at risk and their financial future is not so certain and their job is not so certain. So I view this as a real opportunity spiritually for churches and ministries to reach out to people who are clearly hurting and in need.
Well, thank you, General Paxton, David, for coming on today. We know that you have unusually busy schedules right now, so we are very grateful and thankful that you would take the time to meet with us and with those on the call.
Hey, thank you for what you guys do. It's critically important. You guys are providing lots of resources and answers and help for people that really need it right now, and I'm really grateful that you guys are around to do it.
Well, our pleasure, and thanks very much again. Well, Justin, I'm really glad you asked that question. I'm really glad you asked that question about how the Attorney General in a state must balance between the various interests, whether that's from the White House or the governor or the mayor of a small town. Some of what we have seen in the last week, it seems, is just the kinks being worked out as everyone tries their very best to implement its best defense against this virus.
Yeah, I think that's right. For example, this week we sent a letter to the city of McKinney, Texas. And McKinney is located in Collin County, and county officials had generally followed what Governor Abbott had directed in terms of respecting how religious organizations like churches are to be treated, which was why it was surprising then that McKinney would impose very strict limits on religious ministry. And while the city made allowances for fast food restaurants to stay open by serving through the drive-thru and by pickup order, churches who wanted to distribute food to those in need couldn't. And this is a time when ministries like this are especially important. I know a lot of churches are providing meals to kids who usually get any of their meals through the public schools, which obviously aren't open right now. So this limitation was surprising, but we sent McKinney a letter explaining some of the problems with their order, and they quickly corrected the issues.
Well, I like that story because it reminds us that there may be some clunky overreach as everyone adjusts to these social distancing requirements. But it's good for us to remind our elected officials that their actions also have consequences. But it's also important to point out that these officials are usually very quick to adjust when problems like this are pointed out.
That's right. And let's not miss something here. Everyone seems to be understanding that restrictions on religious liberty, even if temporary, are not what America is about. And yes, there's a place for tolerating these restrictions to help our neighbor, but we also have to value the First Amendment. But we also value the First Amendment for a reason. And I hope that once we come through this, we'll continue to be vigilant about our first freedom here in America.
Yes, very, very well said. All right, let's turn now to another major development in the last week, which is the CARES Act. A week ago, President Trump signed into law a $2 trillion, that's with a T, a $2 trillion relief package meant to bridge the gap while the economy is, well, if you'll excuse the metaphor, in a bit of a coma due to the shelter-in-place requirements under the law that we're under. Those of you who understand how First Liberty Institute works know that we often partner with lawyers to litigate important matters of religious freedom. These network attorneys also work pro bono on our cases, and one of those network attorneys is a gentleman by the name of Matt Martins. Matt is a partner at WilmerHale, one of the largest law firms in the world. Before he joined WilmerHale, Matt worked for the U.S. Department of Justice under President George W. Bush, and then as Chief Litigation Counsel for the Division of Enforcement at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Matt is also a graduate of Cedarville College, the University of North Carolina School of Law, as well as Dallas Theological Seminary. In addition to all that, he clerked for Chief Justice William Rehnquist at the U.S. Supreme Court. I know Matt best from working with him to defend a very small synagogue in Orange County, California a few years ago, on the eve of Yom Kippur, to successfully protect their right to practice a millennia-old religious tradition, yeah, that involved chickens. More on that, if you're curious, is available for you to read at firstliberty.org. But today, we've asked Matt to join us to help evaluate the CARES Act. So, Matt, thanks for joining us.
Jeremy, I'm glad to be here. I've really enjoyed working with you all over the last several years. Frankly, it's been one of the most satisfying parts of my practice. So thanks for having me.
Well, let me ask you this. There's a number of questions that have been asked and to ask about this new law. And let me start kind of broad, and then I'm going to allow you to get as specific as you care to do. What is the CARES Act, and why should churches and religious organizations and those who lead it listening on this call today, why should they care about it?
Well, there's a number of aspects to the CARES Act, but I think the portions that would probably be most relevant to you, to your listeners, are threefold. One, there's a provision in the CARES Act that's a $350 billion grant or government backing of loans for payroll protection, what's referred to as the Payroll Protection Act. And that's administered under the Small Business Administration Act, Section 7A, which has historically been a program that's available for small businesses in the United States to get financing that they might not otherwise be available for. As part of the CARES Act, Congress expanded that program to allow not-for-profits, including religious not-for-profits, faith-based not-for-profits, including churches, to apply for those loans. And as a second aspect, those loans can be forgiven up to certain amounts to the extent that they are spent on certain things, mainly payroll expense. And so certain nonprofits could be eligible for reimbursement, or excuse me, forgiveness of those loans for payroll expense that they spend over the 8 weeks after the loan is originated. In addition, there's also been some adjustment to encourage charitable giving during this time to help folks out. And so if you're someone who would be subject to the cap on deductible charitable contributions, or if you're someone who doesn't itemize deductions and thus wouldn't be able to take advantage of a deduction for charitable giving, Congress has amended the law to provide for a deduction in both of those circumstances. And then lastly, there's a deferral of payroll tax payments. Employer side payroll tax payments are deferred for some period of time during 2020 to give, again, people some breathing room here and during a time when they're probably short on cash.
Well, thanks for that summary, Matt. And I know the attorneys at WilmerHale did a really fine job of making public a summary of the many parts, not just those that relate to religious organizations, of the CARES Act, which those listening can download at WilmerHale.com. One of our questions that we received from Christian in Fort Worth asks, he wrote in with a series of questions that basically asked this: if a religious nonprofit were to participate in the loans or grants that are found in the Act, would they then be subject to the non-discrimination laws of the federal government? Would they be forced to spend the monies in a neutral fashion, meaning that they could not be used to further their religious purpose?
So that's an issue that we have been very focused on here. One of the first questions I got when I started talking with organizations, I guess a week ago now, churches in particular, was what are the strings attached for these loans that could impact the functioning of religious organizations? And the Section 7A loans do have a non-discrimination provision attached to them, which prohibits discrimination both on the basis of religion, but with an exception for religious organizations and educational institutions, and also on the basis of sex, which I know could be relevant to perhaps some of your listeners who have 10 churches or have churches that limit clergy, for example, on the basis of sex. And so over the last week, there's been significant analysis and effort to work with the administration to work through these issues. And I think where we've landed is that the administration has provided assurance that the statutes will, or the statute and the regulations will be not, will not be interpreted in a way to impinge on the religious liberty of churches or other religious institutions that apply.
Well, it's good news, because a lot of people have asked that question. Even during this call, we've received more questions from on email about that very thing. Let me also just take a moment to remind our listeners to send us your questions each week and throughout the week at askfli@firstliberty.org. We can't get to all of those questions, but we certainly do try. Remember, we're focusing our questions, or our answers rather, on questions about religious liberty in particular. So help us by focusing your questions on those important aspects of the situation related to religious liberty. But Matt, let me get back to you. One of our listeners in Houston named Hardy, he asked a question about whether we foresee any religious liberty issues with the church accepting an SBA Paycheck Protection Program loan. Your thoughts?
So Hardy, thanks for your question. I think what I would say is that certainly in the application process, you'll have to make representations that, again, you won't discriminate on the in a way that's inconsistent with the law. But as I mentioned, I believe that the administration has provided assurances that that those will not be interpreted in a way that impinge on religious liberty. as I mentioned, the two issues that could be applicable are discrimination on basis of religion, but that prohibition is explicitly eliminated for religious, for churches or educational institutions. So I don't think there's an issue there. And again, whether the sex discrimination provision would apply to your church would depend on what your church's position is with regard to clergy and who can serve in those roles. But even then, I believe that the administration has understood that, or has taken a position that that will not be interpreted in a way that's inconsistent with religious liberty.
And I believe that the administration issued a rule noting that, that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, as well as the religion clauses of the Constitution, apply to this to the CARES Act, and that the CARES Act will be interpreted in light of those statutory and constitutional protections.
That's right. That was the basis for their conclusion, is that every statute that Congress enacts, unless it's explicitly excluded from the application of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, is subject to it, and that provides a basis for interpreting the statute or the rule, as the case may be, to exempt or provide exceptions when needed to preserve religious liberty.
Well, that's very helpful for us to think through, and for those on the call, we're grateful for that. And I would encourage folks to go not only to firstliberty.org to evaluate this further, but download the guidance that Wilmer Hale has put together at wilmerhale.com. So, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today and for this very clear explanation of the CARES Act and how it applies to churches and religious organizations.
And again, thanks for having me, and I'm always glad to work with you guys, and thanks for the invite.
Well, Jeremy, we should probably end by quickly discussing what is perhaps the biggest issue that arose this week, something you've already mentioned, and that is we saw New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio suggest that he may permanently close houses of worship if they don't follow the city's orders on large gatherings. And we've also seen some pastors really dig in and face the prospect of arrest warrants for keeping their churches open. What do we make of all of that?
Well, first, I would point folks to an article out this morning in the Washington Post written by our boss, Kelly Shackelford, the president of First Liberty Institute, along with Dr. Albert Moeller, from the president of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. But look, I think everyone is just trying to do their best right now in a really difficult and scary time. And frankly, I think Americans will tolerate a lot, including the temporary restriction of some of their most treasured freedoms. But they're not going to tolerate a permanent shutdown of religious freedoms, and nor should they. Careless comments like Mayor de Blasio's don't really help calm the situation at all. At the same time, it's good for us to remember that now's the time for prudence over defiance. The church needs the state's public health apparatus right now, and it's good for us to trust in that. But the state really needs the care, the comfort, and the calm that only America's houses of worship can provide right now. I think we would do well to remember the words of Reverend I. Cochran Hunt. He was a Presbyterian minister that responded to the public health orders to stay home during the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. He told the Cincinnati Inquirer, quote, "I believe the action of the authorities in prohibiting public gatherings was a wise move, and they should be endorsed and assisted by the entire public in stamping out this disease." Well, yesterday I participated also in a call with the White House, along with a lot of other organizations, and their repeated message was that we encourage everyone to work together, not only by washing our hands and not touching our faces and staying home from work or in public if you're feeling sick, but that we support those that are out there on the front lines. There are healthcare workers right now that are scared that they may be carrying the coronavirus home to their kids at night. Others are wondering if they have enough face masks and other protective equipment to protect them while they care for their patients. When the Spanish flu came to Cincinnati, the Bishop of Cincinnati, Ferdinand Brossart, he directed his diocese to stay home, concluding that they ought to strictly comply with the public health orders of sheltering in place. And while there, he says, quote, "Pray that the impending plague may be averted." Well, maybe that's where our focus should be right now, more than anything else, is praying that the plague would be averted.
Yeah, and I know our healthcare workers and our politicians would really appreciate those prayers right now as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, Justin, I think we're all out of time. Just a reminder to those listening to the call, back in, we'll be back at the same time and at the same number next week, noon Eastern time, at the same number you dialed in this morning. Be sure to invite your friends and your colleagues who you think would benefit from being on this call as well.
And be sure to send us your questions throughout the week. You can send them anytime to askfli@firstliberty.org. And we hope we answered Christian's and Hardy's questions adequately this week, and we hope to address yours next week.
Until then, keep checking firstliberty.org for more information, along with recordings like this one. And until then, I'm Jeremy Dice.
And I'm Justin Butterfield.
Have a safe and healthy weekend. We'll talk with you guys next time.